Then, said Joachim, all those who do not yet bear this mark of Satan must flee. Dietrich rubbed the stubble on his chin. And the ill can be restrained from flight, lest they spread the small lives farther abroad. He glanced at Joachim, but said nothing of logic. Ja, doch. It is little enough, but it is something. Max was the natural leader of such a flight. He knew the forests better than any but Gerlach the hunter, and was more accustomed to leading men than was Gerlach. Dietrich went to the Hare stables and saddled a sleek black courser. He had tightened the cinch and was proposing that the beast accept the bit when Manfred's voice said, I could have you flogged for your presumption. Dietrich turned to find the Hare behind him, bearing a great hunting bird on his left forearm. Manfred nodded toward the horse. Only a knight may ride a courser. But when Dietrich began to remove the bridle, he shook his head. Nah, who will care? I came forth only because I remembered my birds and thought to free them before they starved. I was in the rookery when I heard you fumbling around. I plan to unbar the kennel and the stable, too, so it is well you came now. I suppose you mean to flee, as Rudolf did. The ease of the supposition angered Dietrich, not least because it struck too truly, but he only said, I go to find Max. Manfred raised his gauntlet and stroked the falcon, which craned its neck, sidestepped a bit on the thick leather glove, and screeched. You know what the gauntlet means, don't you, precious one? You yearn to spread your wings and fly, don't you? Max has flown, too, I suppose, or he would have returned ere now. Dietrich made no answer, and Manfred continued. But it is bred into his character to return to me. Not Max. This beauty, Max, too, now I think on it. He'll circle and circle, searching for the welcoming arm below, and will not see it. Is it right to release him to such sorrow? Mein Herr, surely he will accustom himself to his new circumstances. So he will, Manfred answered sadly. He will forget me, and the hunts we carried out together. That is why the falcon symbolizes love. You cannot keep a falcon. You must release him, and then he will return of his own will, or fly to other lands. You know the term. Did you study falconry? You are a man of parts, Dietl. A Paris scholar, yet you know horsemanship, and perhaps hunting with birds. I think you were gently born, yet you never speak of your youth. Mein Herr knows the circumstances in which he found me. Manfred grimaced. Most delicately put. Indeed I do. And had I not seen you stay the mob at Rheinhausen, I would have left you there to be slaughtered with the rest of them. Yet it has, on the whole, been well. I have copied many of our conversations in memoranda. I never told you that. I am no scholar, though I think myself a practical man, and have always delighted in your ideas. Do you know how you make a falcon return to you? Mein Herr, Dietrich, after all these years, you and I may dozen and dispense with formalities. Very well. Manfred, one cannot make a falcon return, though one may easily bar it from returning. A falconer must master his emotions, must make no sudden moves that could frighten the bird off.
Would that more lovers knew that art, Dietrich.
He laughed, and then in sudden silence his face grew long.
Eugen has the fever.
May God save him.
Manfred's lips twitched.
His death is the end of my Gundel. She'll not live without him.
May God deny her wish.
Do you think God hears you any more? I think he has gone away from the world. I think he has grown disgusted with men and will have no more to do with us.
Manfred stepped outside the mews and with a sweep of his arm launched the falcon.
God has flown to other lands, I think.
He watched for a moment, admiring the bird's beauty, before he ducked back inside the mews.
I hate to break troth with him in such a manner.
He meant the bird. Manfred, death is but a falcon launched to fly to other lands.
The Hare smiled without humor.
Apropos, but perhaps too easy. When you return with the black, give him hay, but do not stable him. I must see to the other beasts.
He turned, hesitated, then spread his arms.
You and I may never meet again.
Dietrich took the embrace.
We may, should God grant us both our heart's desires.
And not our deserts. So, we part on a jest. What else can a man do amid such sorrow?
Dietrich did not at first notice Max, save that the heavy buzz of flies under the summer heat led him to the spot. He hunched his shoulders and slid from the horse's back, tying the beast with special care to a nearby oak. Procuring a kerchief, he plucked blossoms from patches of wild flowers and crushed them within the cloth to release their perfume. Before tying the kerchief to his face, he broke off a branch from a hazel bush, and using it as a broom swept it across the sergeant's body, dispersing its aerial diners. Then, with as much dispassion as he could muster, he looked upon the carcass of his friend. The physicians of Bologna and Padua had made anatomies on bodies dried in the sun or consumed in the earth or submerged in running water, but Dietrich did not think they had ever done so on a body in this state. His stomach leapt through his mouth, and so visited a final indignity on the man. When he had recovered and had refreshed his flower pocket, Dietrich confirmed what he had glimpsed. Max had been stabbed in the back. His jerkin was rent there at the kidneys, and a great gout of blood had issued forth. He had fallen forward in the act of drawing his quillion, for he lay upon his right arm with the handle of the long dagger in his death-hardened grip, and the blade half out of its sheath. Dietrich staggered to a nearby stone, a block that had tumbled countless years before from the escarpment overhead. There he sobbed. For Max, for Lawrence, for Hervey, one eye, and all the others. Dietrich returned to the hospital after Vespers. For a time he watched Hans and Joachim and the others walk among the sufferers, applying cool cloths to fevered brows, spooning food into indifferent mouths, washing the bandages used to cover the sores in tubs of hot soapy water, and laying them out to dry, a practice Hugh de Luca and others had commended. At last Dietrich stepped inside where Gregor watched over his ailing son.
"Everyone says he has my face," Gregor said. "And maybe that's true when he's awake and tries to be like me, but when he's asleep, he remembers that he's her firstborn, and her shade looks out at me from inside his heart."
He was silent for a moment.
"I must look after Sibke. The two of them fought, always scuffling like two bear cubs."
Gregor craned his neck.
"Gregor's not a pious boy. He mocks the church, despite my scolds."
"The choice is God's, not ours. And God acts not from petty spite, but from boundless love." Gregor looked around the smithy.
"Boundless love," he repeated. "Is that what this is?"
"It is no comfort," Hans interjected. "But we Krenkin know this. There is no other manner in which the world could be fashioned that would bear life. There are numbers, the strength of the bonds that hold the atoms together, the strength of the electronic essence, the attraction of matter."
"Ach!" He tossed his arm.
"The sentences in my head wander, and it was not my calling. We have shown that these numbers can be no other. The smallest change in any, and the world would not stand. All that happens in this world follows from these numbers. Sky and stars, sun and moon, rain and snow, plants and animals and small lives."
"God has ordered all things," Dietrich quoted from the Book of Wisdom, "by weight and measure and number."
"Doch, and from those numbers come also ills and afflictions and death and the pest. Yet had the hair in the sky ordered the world in any other way, there would be no life at all." Dietrich remembered that Master Buridan had compared the world to a great clock that God has wound and which swung now by its own instrumental causes.
"You are right, monster," Gregor said. "It is no comfort."
Heloise Krenkren died the next day. Hans and Ulf carried her body to the church and laid it out on a bench that Joachim had prepared. Then Dietrich left them alone for the private rites that he had implicitly condoned. Afterward, in the parsonage, Hans held his flask up to the window.
"This many days only remain," he said, tracing the level with his fingertip. "I will not see you through to the end.